So this is cirrhosis. It's got bumps all over this stinking place. Got these regenerative nodules. This is a histologic section of it. And you can see these nodules. Anybody see any triads in there? Nope. I mean, there's not even a space in there. Why? Because it's wall-to-wall hepatocytes. Okay, and it's surrounded by fibrous tissue. Now, this crap about micronodular and macronodular really, really irritates me. If it's less than 3 millimeters, it is micronodular. If it's greater than 3 millimeters, it's macronodular. And then they test you on this. Well, I wonder how you would answer Lennox cirrhosis, because it starts out micronodular and ends up macronodular. So how would you answer that question? The answer is, guys, it's totally retarded, because cirrhosis is cirrhosis. And whether they're small nodules, large nodules, or a mixture of the two, you still have the same problem. It's total bullcrap. Okay, just wanted to just get my 2 cents in on that. Okay. Now, you can see that we've got a liver here, and it looks like we've got a lot of liver cells here, but they're not working. How is the portal vein there if we're going to empty blood into this liver when there aren't any sinusoids and triads in it? The answer is it's having problems. That's why you get portal hypertension. And all the complications related to that, and all the metabolic things are all screwed up. So let's look at some complications. Have you seen this before? Good, good. Okay, so we have pitting edema, we have ascites, we talked about the Stallings force abnormalities there, we have esophageal varices related to portal hypertension. Then we can deal with some of its metabolic problems. You can't metabolize estrogen, okay, and so you get gynecomastia. Now, by the way, you cannot look at gynecomastia and say, that's gynecomastia. No way, you'd have to feel it. You have to feel it, okay? You have to feel breast tissue. A lot of guys that are fat look like they have gynecomastia. They just have fat, you know, these big fat little boobs there, okay? But, you know, you go underneath there, there's nothing. There's nothing. There's no muscle. There's no breast tissue either. You got to feel the dude. Now, remember, guys, we have boobs 3 times in our life, and I'm at the last stage of it right now. Newborn males have boobs. Why? The estrogen effect of mommy. Newborn baby girls have periods. Because they have estrogen stimulation from mommy when she's in utero, and the baby's born, there's a drop-off of estrogen, boom, they have vaginal bleeding. All that's normal. And then when we get to be in puberty, guys, we also get it. And then when we get old, okay, and testosterone goes down, then the estrogen that we do have normally starts assuming prominence, and so we get gynecomastia again. So 3 times in our life, newborn, puberty, old age, gynecomastia is normal. Normal. Now, by the way, many of you think, here's a board question. A 13-year-old boy has a unilateral subarillary mass. Unilateral. The management of this patient is excise it, spit on it, whatever. Leave it alone. Okay, what's your answer? Leave it alone. See, a lot of you think that gynecomastia is always bilateral. Wrong. Most of the time it's unilateral. I submit to you, no woman has exactly the same size breast on both sides. That's been documented. Why? Because each breast has a different sensitivity to estrogen, progesterone, or prolactin. And so they're not exactly equal because they don't respond similarly. Now, since men have hardly any breast tissue in there, it's more likely that one would be enlarged and the other one would be normal. So most of the time it is unilateral. And don't be surprised and don't pick cancer because it's unilateral. That's the way it normally is. This happened to be in this patient unilateral. This is palmar erythema. That's related to estrogen. There's a spider angioma, which you've already seen. This shows vitamin deficiencies are common in cirrhosis. This is Dupuytren's contracture. Dupuytren's contracture is the most common fibromatosis. I think you can see a cord right there in the palm, okay, and that's caused this finger to be brought down, so you can see the cord over there. It's a fibromatosis, so you're getting increased fibrous tissue around the tendon sheaths, and it's causing the fingers to coil in, okay. Very, very commonly associated with alcoholics, but not necessarily always, but it is common, and they do like it on boards to know about Dupuytren's contractures. So we have estrogen types of abnormalities there. Men will get impotent because of the high estrogen levels, too. Okay, now I put this up here because this is a complication of ascites. Now this happens to be what? A rod or a coccus? A rod. Okay, so this must have been an adult with ascites, and the organism that's producing this spontaneous peritonitis is E. coli. Very good. However, if you have a child, let's say, with nephrotic syndrome who has ascites, and they get spontaneous peritonitis, what's the organism? Streptococcus pneumoniae. So in kids, spontaneous peritonitis in ascites is due to strep pneumoniae, whereas in adults with ascites, which usually is going to be in association with cirrhosis, it's E. coli, commonly asked question. And when I say spontaneous, I mean spontaneous. It's not that you ruptured your bowel or anything like that, just spontaneously occurs. Hepatocellular carcinoma. I picked the two best pictures that I had in my collection. Actually, promote these are about the only ones. Okay, now this has obviously been fixed in formalin. This is a relatively fresh specimen. Now, what do you see here as a background? What do you see? You see nodularity, don't you? And then you see this big goober over here. What do we see here? Well, we see a lot of nodularity in there, but then we see some, you know, this one's whiter or paler than that. And then you can see a little bit more pale. Whoa, that's cancer, actually, in a big hepatic vein tributary over there. So this one's a little bit more subtle. The point is this. Hepatocellular carcinoma almost always, not always, but almost always develops in a background of cirrhosis. That's the point you want to remember. It's very, very rare for hepatocellular carcinoma to develop without having an underlying cirrhosis present. Now, most of you probably think, and like I did, that since alcohol is the most common cause of cirrhosis, then it also must be the most common cause of hepatocellular carcinoma. Nope, not even close. It's one of the least likely ones to do that. Actually, one of the more common ones is pigment cirrhosis from hemochromatosis, and then, of course, the post-necrotic cirrhosis from hepatitis B and C. And as I told you, there's a raging argument about which one's more common. My sources say it's like a 35% chance or so for B, 30% for C. It's very close. Who cares? Okay, so hepatitis B and C can do. Those are the big ones right there. Those are the more common causes of hepatocellular carcinoma. Remember, they have ectopic hormones, erythropoietin, and then insulin-like factors, so they can get hypoglycemia and secondary polycythemia. And they have a tumor marker, alpha-fetoprotein. How are you going to recognize it on an exam? Well, say that it's a patient that has an underlying cirrhosis with ascites and is pretty stable, and suddenly the ascites gets worse and the patient's beginning to lose weight. That should automatically make you start being suspicious. They will almost always say they do a peritoneal tap and it's hemorrhagic. So they have blood in the acidic fluid. Now, just don't assume that's traumatic, you know, from the stick, unless they say it. Okay? If they say there's blood in the acidic fluid, it's a pathologic bleeding there. So that kind of history, weight loss, suddenly the patient's beginning to deteriorate, there's blood in the acidic fluid, okay, you know that's hepatocellular carcinoma. But they won't ask that. They'll say, what are the following tests are you going to do? Okay, look for alpha-fetoprotein, because that's going to be the answer to the question. Okay? All right. I've seen a number of cases of hepatocellular carcinoma already. What's this? Remember what the rule I said. If you see multiple things in any tissue, right, what is it? Metastasis, okay? You see multiple things there. You see multiple things there. I picked the two best pictures that are available in the pathology slides that everyone, pathologists all have. So it'll be one of these two if they were to put a liver up with metastasis. Now, play odds. Lung, very good. Non-smoker. This is classic what they would do. They put this up there, and they'll say that the patient's a non-smoker, and they'll say the most likely cause of this. First, they'll put hepatocellular carcinoma, which, of course, is incorrect. Okay? What do you think it'd be then? Colon. Because it's less of a relationship. Now, colon cancer can be due to smoking, but it's not the most common thing. So the next best choice would be metastatic colon cancer. Okay? You certainly wouldn't want to pick, if it's a non-smoker, a primary in the lung. Forget it. So you go to the next best one. And they've been doing that lately, as I told you, remember? Bowel obstruction, and they say the patient didn't have surgery. So you had to rule out adhesions as the cause. You had to go to the next most common one, which is an indirect inguinal hernia sac, and that was the answer. So they're doing that. So you got to know probably the first two things. So that if you can exclude one, let's say smoker versus non-smoker, then you're going to pick the other choice. All right, gallbladder disease. Part two deals a lot with gallbladder disease, but part one only asks you something this simple. And they're asking about the pathogenesis of the stones. Okay, so here's the answer to that one. The answer is too much cholesterol in bile, too little bile salts. So you have too much cholesterol, so you have a supersaturated bile with cholesterol, and you're going to get the most common stone, which is this, cholesterol stones. Or too little bile salts. Both predispose to stones. So too much cholesterol, too little bile salts. So in other words, any of the things we talked about that produce bile salt deficiency, from cirrhosis to obstruction to cholestyramine to Crohn's disease, all could predispose to gallstones because there's too little bile salts. You understand? All right. Now you can see that these stones over here are not yellow, like these. So you know for sure that they're not cholesterol stones. So I'll say this is a 25-year-old female that had right upper quadrant, crampy pain, fever, neutrophilic leukocytosis, point tenderness on examination of the right upper quadrant. Ultrasound revealed stones. Okay, they were removed. Here they are. The CBC shows a mild normocytic anemia and a corrective reticulocyte count of 8%. Splenomegaly was also present on exam, and there's a family history of splenectomy, which is your diagnosis. Well, she's got congenital spherocytosis, and because she's been hemolyzing red blood cells all her life, there's a lot more conjugation of bilirubin into conjugated bilirubin, so she has supersaturated bile with bilirubin, and she forms calcium bilirubinate stones, which are jet black. They love that question. They love that question. Okay. So make sure you know that. Here's an ultrasound showing this. The screening test of choice for stones is ultrasound. Listen to this before I possibly forget it. The screening test of choice for anything in the pancreas is CT. And the reason why that is, even though it's more expensive than ultrasound, is that it bowels ovalized pancreas and screws up ultrasound. And so it's not as sensitive. So any question relative to the pancreas and what your first step in management is, always put CT. Never put ultrasound. But for gallbladder, ultrasound. It even tell you the diameter of the common bile duct so you can tell whether there's any stone in the common bile duct. Okay? All right. Have you seen this before? Yeah, this over here was in the context of cystic fibrosis. Okay, remember we talked about the growth alteration that this would be with all this interstitiated mucus and these ducts in the pancreas. Okay, and they asked what was the growth alteration. The answer is atrophy, because when you put when you block the lumens there of those exocrine ducts, then the pressure goes back to the glands. And that pressure atrophies the glands, and then now you end up with malabsorption. Can cystic fibrosis kids also develop diabetes? Absolutely, because eventually fibrose off also the islet cells, and they get type 1 diabetes too. Absolutely. So let's just talk a little bit more about cystic fibrosis. Guys are into the molecular biology now of cystic fibrosis, as they are with other genetic diseases. So listen carefully to Reichenbach when he goes through a lot of his stuff on genetics. He gets, because he is an expert on DNA, he gets into the molecular aspects. Also, make sure you read my high yields, because I put my genetics notes in there too, and I have all those same things too, and a couple more. Whoa. Now, chromosome 7, 3 nucleotide deletion is what the problem is. And those 3 nucleotides are coded for phenylalanine. So you're deficient in phenylalanine in the cystic fibrosis transmembrane regulator protein. So all that's missing is the phenylalanine. Okay, and as you know, most things, after they're made in the ribosomes on the endoplasmic reticulum, have post-translational modification to just kind of fix them up a little bit in the Golgi apparatus. Agreed? And so that's where the real defect is. Yeah, The cystic fibrosis, it's got abnormal in that it's missing a phenylalanine. But the real problem is when it gets into the Golgi apparatus, it's supposed to be modified so that it can be secreted to the cell surface, okay? It's screwed up, and so it actually ends up being degraded in the cell, and so you end up actually having no cystic fibrosis transmembrane regulator. So the problem is in the Golgi apparatus. It screws it up, and it eventually never makes it to the surface, and so it has no function. So what does it do? Well, in the sweat glands, it would reabsorb sodium and chloride out of the sweat glands. That's its normal function. So if you were deficient in this, then you would be losing salt. And that's the basis of the sweat test. Also, they commonly will say with this, you have a little three-year-old kid who has failure to thrive, has lots of chronic diarrhea and respiratory infections. And mother states that her baby tastes salty when she kisses the baby. That's the absolute giveaway for cystic fibrosis, because they do lose considerable salt, and they can become salt depleted if they get overheated. But listen carefully on this. Why do they get inspissated mucus like this? Why are all the secretions so thick in the lungs and in the pancreas and in the bile ducts? Why? Well, what does cystic fibrosis transmembrane regulator do there? Let's take the lungs, for example. Why do they get all that lung disease? Why is the mucus so thick? Answer, you've got to have salt in the secretions in the lumens of the respiratory tract to keep it viscous, so it's nice and loose. And here's what happens. If you're missing cystic fibrosis transmembrane regulator, sodium is reabsorbed out of the secretions in the airway. That's not good. You can automatically see that's going to kind of make them a little bit kind of dehydrated. And chloride can't be pumped in to the lumen of the airway. So you're taking out the two important ingredients. You're taking sodium out, and you're not putting chloride in. Therefore, those secretions are concrete. You're taking sodium out, and you can't put chloride in, can't pump it in, because you're missing that pump. Okay? And so you end up with the secretions. The same thing is true for these secretions here in the pancreas. Sodium's being sucked out, and chloride's not being pumped in, and so they're thick like concrete. Okay? So that's how that works in cystic fibrosis. Most common cause of death is infection due to Pseudomonas aeruginosa. And also remember, they're asking questions on fertility on this. They say, what's the percent chance, actually, for a male with cystic fibrosis of having children? Well, look at between 0 and 5%. Okay, that would be it for a male. In other words, they're almost most of them are infertile. So look for something less than 5% as an answer. For females, they can get pregnant, but they only have about a 30% chance for getting pregnant. So they're not totally infertile, but they certainly have a little bit better percent chance than a male. The problem, if you're interested, is that the cervical mucus is as thick as concrete, and so the sperms can't penetrate it. Okay, they can't penetrate through, and that's one of the reasons why they're infertile. Okay, so that's cystic fibrosis. Okay, this is, you've seen this before, this is acute pancreatitis. Okay, and you know that's most commonly due to alcohol. Also, second most common is a little stone that gets caught in one of those little accessory ducts there in the pancreas. And amylase is elevated. And remember the characteristic pain, epigastric pain with radiation into the back, because it's a retroperitoneal organ. Another one that's possibly asked on part one, more common too. Let's say they have a history of acute pancreatitis, and let's say after about 10 days you feel a mass in the abdomen, okay? And then they ask you, what do you do? What test do you do? Okay, that's what they would ask for part two. The answer, you do a CT. What do you think it is? It's a pseudocyst, okay? On part one, they wouldn't ask you about the CT. They'd say, what do you think it is? The answer is, it's a pancreatic pseudocyst. There's a lot of fluid that develops around an inflamed pancreas, and then it sort of accumulates and it forms a false capsule to it, and so this thing just keeps on building up, and there's a potential for it to rupture. Now, not a very good thing to have amylase in your peritoneal cavity. Not good. And so That's what that is. I want you to look at this, please. Now, they usually don't have arrows pointing to it, okay? They probably would get them out with a computer. So they give some kind of history on this patient. And what do you see over here? It's the right upper quadrant, right? What are these little dots? Dystrophic calcification. Okay, so what do you think it is? Pancreatitis. Probably, since there's so many of them, acute or chronic? Chronic. And it's most likely a patient who's a diabetic. There you go. I mean, alcoholic. Excuse me. That's right. All right, what else would you expect? I mean, they may think that that's something you should know anyway. Maybe they could say something like this. They could say, which of the following clinical abnormalities would you expect this patient to have? And maybe one of them could be steatorrhea. Would that be a clinical one? Would that be? Sure, because remember, that's one of the causes of malabsorption. You need enzymes. Or maybe they could say, would you have bile salt deficiency? No. What does the pancreas have to do with bile salts? Nothing. So that wouldn't be. That would be a good distractor, wouldn't it? How about... I just love it when I think like this. Could they have a hemorrhagic diathesis? Yes, from what? Vitamin K deficiency related to malabsorption. Ooh, isn't that cool? Not really. I didn't think about it. Now you did. You know, so what? Whatever. So there's a number of ways you can go with this particular question, okay, and make it very interesting and integrative. Last picture here is a carcinoma, the head of the pancreas, okay, which is the most common location, I might add. And so most of the time it's going to be a smoker, okay, because that's the most common cause of it. Or the second most common cause would be chronic pancreatitis as a potential possibility. And they're usually going to have what they call painless jaundice, light-colored stools, palpable gallbladder, that's called Courvoisier sign. And they'll have, the jaundice will be primarily conjugated bilirubin. And that's carcinoma of the head of the pancreas. Okay, this is the C sign, because when you have carcinoma of the head of the pancreas, it's permanently indenting the duodenum. And so we can do a barium study. You can see that this duodenum looks like the letter C over here. And that's also a sign on X-ray of pancreatic cancer. Okay. Now, while I'm glad I just put this up here, because it just dawned on me another very interesting question on part one. Let's make believe for fun. Let me see. Let me go back here. Okay. This is acute pancreatitis. Yeah. And there's inflammation here, right? Yeah. What do you think it's going to do to peristalsis of that duodenum right next to it? How does the bowel react to the presence of inflammation next to it? It stops peristalsing. You mean throughout the entire bowel? Nope, just there. So if that's true then there would just be air there in that area where it didn't peristalse. That's correct, because you couldn't be able to push the air beyond it. Do you know what that's called? Sentinel sign. That's a sentinel sign. What's a sentinel? That's someone supposed to keep watch. In this case, keep watch for what? Inflammation. They asked that on part one. And the classic area is the pancreas, where you see that. And that's called localized ileus. Ileus, by definition, means is a lack of peristalsis. And whenever the bowel lacks peristalsis, you're going to see air there. Lots of air will accumulate because it's not moving. You'll get distension. So if they ask that, then I can think of another one. What if you had a segment of bowel that was distended in the right lower quadrant? Well, it has to be inflammation, so what's in the right lower quadrant? Your cecum, and what's hanging off the cecum? So it could be appendicitis producing a sentinel sign. So that, that's how you think with these dudes. If they ask sentinel sign for pancreatitis, you know that the next one they're going to ask deals with right lower quadrant appendicitis, and you get a sentinel sign. So that was part one. Good question. Good question. There's no reason why it can't be on part two also. Okay. Kidney. We start kidney. Oh, I know. I know what you're scared of. You know what you're scared of?
Well, I'm scared of glomerulus nephritis. I can spit.
Well, I don't think I'd spit over it. Not all that bad, actually.
Oh, you always say that, and then you talk about it, and I'm more confused.
I hope not, because if that's true, then I'm doing a bad job. It's not hard. And what you need to know about it isn't all that much, actually.
But it's got electron microscopy.
So what? If I show you all the ones that they've shown on boards, would that make you happy? Say yes, because that's what I'm going to do. All right. We're not going there right now, though. I want to get you set up for it. Okay. The first section you notice in the notes deals with your analysis. And what I'm going to do here is not actually go through each part of this, but as we get to different things that relate to things that are abnormalities in urine, then we'll do them. That way we don't have to waste all that time in duplicating everything. However, I do know ahead of time that there are a couple things that really I'm not going to be talking about, so I want to show you them. And as this one right here, I want you to know that what a cast is. Now, you know what it is when you have a broken extremity. Isn't it a mold of your leg, you know, or your arm? Well, a cast is a mold of whatever is going on in your nephron, in your tubule. And what it is tamhorsefall protein that is congealing around whatever is present in that tubule at that time. And it makes a mold of it that's passed in the urine, and we can see it under the microscope. Guys, you know how important that is? That means you don't have to do a renal biopsy to see what's going on in the tubules, because the cast will tell you what's going on there. For example, if you did have glomerulonephritis, which by definition is inflammation of the glomerulus, don't you think you damage the capillaries and get hematuria? So don't you think there'd be RBCs in your nephron that would be trapped in the cast, and you'll have an RBC cast that tells you, hey, you've got a glomerulonephritis going on there. Agreed? Don't you think that if you had renal tubular necrosis, you've already seen pictures of it, and those tubules are sloughing off by coagulation necrosis from the basement membrane, don't you think they're going to form a cast and they're going to be called renal tubular casts, and it will tell you that they have renal tubular necrosis? Yes or no? Sure. Don't you think that if a woman or a man had acute pyelonephritis where they were neutrophils that were infiltrating the interstitium and the tubules, that there will be a cast of those neutrophils called a white blood cell cast telling you that you have an infection in your kidney? Don't you think that if you're spilling lipid in the urine in nephrotic syndrome, that you're going to form a cast of that fat and form a fatty cast, which you can see and polarize in the urine? So yeah, so important, and yet most physicians, when they order a urine analysis, don't ever look at it, for one. Okay, and if they do look at it, they don't know how to interpret it, for two. And that's been studied, by the way, as a study in the literature. Urinalysis is one of the most common tests ordered, but one of the least common tests looked at, because most physicians have no idea what it all means. And yet they're missing out. Next to a complete blood cell count, I believe a urinalysis has more information about what's going on in the patient than any other test, if you know what you talk, how to interpret things. How about this? The very first thing that disappears when you have renal failure is the ability of the kidney to concentrate urine. That's the very first thing. That was a board question. That's before the BUN and creatinine are even thinking about increasing. That's before there are any renal tubular casts. Your ability to concentrate urine is screwed up. So how about this for something simple? How about taking a urine when a patient, in the first morning void, after a patient's been sleeping overnight, and doing a simple thing like a specific gravity of the urine, and seeing what it is? Because specific gravity can tell you whether it's concentrated or dilute urine. And how about if it specific gravity was greater than 1.023? So what would that mean to me? That would mean that the patient's concentrating urine, and I know for a fact that the kidneys are absolutely, unequivocally normal. Is that a cheap test? But let's say, after an overnight sleep, and I did a specific gravity on that urine, it's 1.010. That's a very, very hypotonic kind of thing. That means that this patient could not concentrate. That means the patient's in renal failure. Is that cheap? Is that simple? But did you know that?
No.
And yet, look at all that information. I have to do BUN creatinine, because that wouldn't help you. Creatinine clearance, that wouldn't really help you. Simple thing, doing a specific gravity. And a urine that should be concentrated if the patient's sleeping overnight. Okay? So I'm trying to get you revved up a little bit, maybe to learn a little bit about urinalysis, because it's very, very important. Now, this is the most benign of all casts. It's sometimes hard to see because it's so ghost-like. But notice it's kind of fuzzy-looking. It's kind of roundish. This is called a hyaline cast. That's basically a cast of a protein. Most of the time, it means nothing. I have them in my urine all the time after a really hard workout. You can spit a little protein normally in your urine. You might have a couple hyaline casts. But most of the time, it's actually a harmless cast. Whereas all other casts usually have some pathologic significance. So I wanted to make sure you knew that a hyaline cast generally means nothing. I just wanted to show you a few crystals, and then we'll move on to the actual pathology. This is a uric acid crystal. They're kind of pretty, actually. Kind of looks like a star, okay? The pH of the urine has to be acid to form a uric acid crystal. Okay, so if you wanted to, let's say you had a patient with gout, and you wanted to stop these crystals from forming, and you know they form in an acid pH, could you please tell me what you'd want to do with the urine? Alkalinizer, could you please tell me how you could do that? Carbonic anhydrase inhibitor would do that, because by blocking bicarbonate reclamation, you alkalinize the urine, and you would prevent these stones from forming. So simple manipulation of the pH could prevent urate nephropathy in a patient. Okay, these I want you definitely to know, because these are calcium oxalate crystals. To me, they look like the back of an envelope, or if you wish, you're playing tic-tac-toe and you put an X in a box. That maybe is better for you if you know what tic-tac-toe is. Does that mean you tick, you tack, and you touch your toe? No. No. It's little X's and zeros. You know what? My little five-year-old grandson beat me in one game of tic-tac-toe. I couldn't believe it. He actually really, without me letting him win, he actually won. And I just went, oh. He was so happy. All right. Now, why is this important for you to know? Why? Well, first of all, they put them on exams. That's important. I think that would be enough right there. But in what context? Why would they want to put that there? How about somebody that's a street person that comes in a stupor state, okay, and it's got an increased anion gap metabolic acidosis, and you're trying to figure out why. You do a urinalysis, and you see a whole pile of these. What did he drink? Ethylene glycol. How about that to begin with? Then how about, what's the most common stone that we pass? Calcium oxalate. You don't honestly think that we won't have calcium oxalate crystals in a patient that's got a calcium oxalate stone, do you? And so they're very important because of these two conditions. Whoa, I'm going to remember this. Good. This other one, forget. They look like coffin lids, don't they? Buffy the Vampire. She's trying to break her way out of the coffin underneath there. Well, I turned that sucker off right away. Buffy the Vampire. What does that mean? All right, guys, what is it? Of course it's a horseshoe kidney. They're not going to ask you that. They're not going to ask you that. Okay. They're not even going to ask you which pole fuses. You can memorize that. They're going to ask what this is. And they're also going to ask, what is restricting the movement of the horseshoe kidney? The inferior mesenteric arteries, the answer. Inferior mesenteric arteries, that's it right there, actually go over it and actually trap the horseshoe kidney behind it. That's what they asked on this. Not that it was a horseshoe kidney. Of course it's a horseshoe kidney. Okay. Okay. Not that it can be seen in Turner syndrome. You can memorize that. They wanted an anatomy thing. They wanted to know what's keeping it in place. What's preventing it from descending or ascending? Answer, the inferior mesenteric artery, which is this, is trapping it there. Whoa, that doesn't seem too important. I agree. But that's what they wanted to ask. cystic diseases of the kidney. I hate anything to do with autopsies of kids because I love the little dudes. I have to show this because these two correlate with each other. It's all kinds of cystic diseases. This one's called infantile polycystic kidney disease, which is autosomal recessive. That means they are present at birth. Now, if this child, look at this poor little dude's kidneys. They're both polycystic. Do you think this baby was urinating? What do you think happened in the amniotic fluid? So that oligohydramnios, huh? And so that poor little dude then is in an amniotic sac with hardly any amniotic fluid around it, and therefore having malformations related to pressure. Look at the nose. Look at the ears on this kid. This is a Potter's facies. Potter's facies. And it's a sign of oligohydramnios in a child with polycystic kidney disease. Guys, this poor little dude wasn't even able to breathe because there was hardly any fluid, and when it tried to breathe, it couldn't. In fact, the lungs are hypoplastic. They never really fully develop because the poor little dude could not fill them up good enough. Isn't that sad? The little dude. It's called Potter's facies. Okay? Infantile polycystic kidney disease. By the way, they're not only in the kidneys, they're in the liver, these cysts, they're in the pancreas, these cysts, so they're just not here. Incompatible with life. Incompatible with life. Now, this is adult polycystic kidney disease. Now, please remember, this is not a kid that had infantile polycystic disease, is now an adult. That was autosomal recessive. This is autosomal dominant, different disease. Are these cysts present at birth? Say no. No. Why? Because autosomal dominant diseases have delayed manifestations. Now, I hope you know what penetrance means, do you? Okay. Penetrance could mean that you have the abnormality when they look for it on the gene, but you wouldn't have any cystic kidney disease. There'd be nothing there. But you do have the genetic abnormality, but you'd never expressed it in your life. That's the good news. What's the bad news? The bad news is you'll transmit it to your kids. So you may not have any evidence of it whatsoever your entire life, but you can transmit it to your kids. That's another bad news. It's hard to recognize on the pedigree. And they do ask it on boards. Okay, Marfan's is a classic one where you can have the abnormality on your chromosome 15 and have nothing, no dislocated lens, no nothing. They're absolutely normal looking, but that person can pass it on to their kids. I know an example of that, actually. It's a friend of my son's. Their daughter has Marfan's. Neither the mother or the father have any evidence whatsoever, but mommy has a family history of sudden death in her family, which they never were able to explain. So they went ahead and did chromosome studies, restriction fragment length polymorphism studies, to find out where, you know, and she had the abnormality in her gene but had no manifestation, so she had no penetrance, but she did pass it on to her daughter. That's called incomplete penetrance. Just think of something sticking through, penetrating. So if it can penetrate through, then it's manifesting itself. Familial polyposis has 100% penetrance. So if you have the gene, you've got the disease. But Marfan's has incomplete penetrance. You can have the gene and never express the disease. That's one of the biggest troubles that students have with genetics, is that concept of penetrance. Now, I like the way I put this together, and I can tell you that on my exam in 1965, there was that kidney and that brain. No, it was that kidney and this brain. I remember it as clear as a bell. So this is adult polycystic kidney disease. It comes up, these cysts, usually by 10, 11, 12 years of age. You will always develop hypertension, okay? And the hypertension is going to predispose to two kinds of bleeds in the brain. One could be the standard thing that you see with hypertension. That's where you make these Charcot-Bouchard aneurysms we talked about, rupture, and you get this. Remember we gave this as a complication of hypertension? Remember that was a blood clot. Remember I said that they can stick needles through silent areas of brain and suck this out? So they could die of this. How would you interpret that, though? That's a brain. What's wrong with it? It's covered by brain. No, covered by brain. It's covered by what? Blood. That means what? If it's covered by blood. Blood got in the subarachnoid space and covered the entire brain. That means it couldn't be due to this. That means it was probably due to a ruptured peri-aneurysm. There you go. Remember that classic thing you learned in medical school? When you ever have blood in the subarachnoid space, as a matter of fact, if you, we get in our hotel here, we get that little U.S. News and World Report, and Sharon Stone, you know, she's recently in a hospital, she had a subarachnoid bleed, and there it was. She said, it was the worst headache I've ever had. That's what they classically say. It's the absolute worst headache you ever had in your entire life when you have blood in your subarachnoid space. And she actually quoted that right as when talking to reporters. Actually quoted that. So that's what they always put in the stem of a question so you know they're talking about a subarachnoid bleed. They always have to put that in there. Okay, now, guys, they know that you know these things about the peri-aneurysm and all that stuff, and so they went on to the next subject with polycystic kidney disease, and that is mitral valve prolapse. Sure enough, that's what they did. So they gave a history of somebody that had hypertension, okay, had some abnormality in ultrasound in the renal pelvis area, and who had, and they described the click murmur. They didn't say mitral valve prolapse. They just described the click murmur thing. So they knew it was mitral valve prolapse, and they asked what was the patient's kidney disease, the cause of hypertension. The answer was adult polycystic kidney disease. So there's a high association of mitral valve prolapse with this. So I already know, being an educator, what the next one will be. Well, what's the next one after the peri-aneurysm thing, after the mitral valve prolapse is diverticulosis. There's a high incidence of diverticulosis in patients with adult polycystic kidney disease. So they're just going right down the line. But are they going to fool us? Are they going to fool us? Say no. No, they're not going to fool us. Because you already know and anticipate what they're going to try to do. Well, how would you do the diverticulosis one, Dr. Goyen? I'd be interested to see how you'd ask that once. A patient with hypertension who has an abnormality on ultrasound in the renal area who has lost 600 mLs of blood all of a sudden from their butt. Okay, so there's hematochezia. What's the most common cause of hematochezia? Diverticulosis. There you go. So I just changed it from a cardiac sign to a butt sign. Hematochezia. There you go, all right? That's how you do it. I'll tell you. I'm glad to know that people have the same kind of interest that I do. All right. Now, here's your bugaboo. Now we're getting into the glomerular stuff, okay? All right. I'm going to show you how easy it is. You ready? Glomerulonephritis. Itis. 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 If it ends in itis, it's type 3 hypersensitivity reaction. How's that for starts? Okay, so does that, all right, so I'm going to say lipoid nephrosis. Is that any immune disease? No, didn't. How about focal segmental glomerulosclerosis? Did that endonitis? No, so it must not be an immunologic disease. So you're getting the point? Good. How about IgA glomerulonephritis? Yes. Diffuse membranous glomerulonephritis? Yes. Diabetic glomerulosclerosis? No. Are you happy now so far? So far, that's pretty easy. Agreed? Okay. Now, when we say diffuse, what are we talking about? We're saying that when we do a renal biopsy, every single glomerulus has something wrong with it. So I'm showing the black here means there's something wrong. So there's three glomeruli, all three were abnormal. So by definition, that's diffuse. So you're saying, well, what's focal? Okay, okay. It means that not all the glomeruli are involved. So I'm showing two that are and one that isn't. So by definition, that's focal disease. Okay, now you got a problem. What if the disease is focal and the disease in the glomerulus is focal? You got a problem. So you could say focal, focal. Okay, that's dangerous because you can run into some bad words with that. Okay, so, you know, you got to be careful, you know, focal, 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 focal. I'm doing okay so far, but I'm not going any further. I can tell you that because I know I'm going to screw up. So we got to come up with another name that's not focal, but describes that within the glomerulus, it's not the whole glomerulus, it's the part. What are you going to come up with? Segmental. Doesn't that mean the same thing as focal? And so they came up with focal segmental. So it'd be something like this. This is a normal glomerulus. This is involved, so it's focal. And in that glomerulus, only one part of it's abnormal, segmental. Okay, so focal segmental. Is that easy so far? Good. All right. Then we use terms like proliferative. What does proliferate mean to you? Lots of them. So if you have more than 100 nuclei, don't count, in a glomerulus consistently, then it's a proliferative type of glomerulonephritis. And all of them have that? Diffuse proliferative glomerulonephritis. Now let's say you look at it, and there, you don't see a lot of dots. Just basically see thick membranes. Okay, then it's membranous. Okay, what if you see both increased numbers of cells and thick membranes? Okay, no problem. Membranal proliferative glomerulonephritis. Actually, whoever made up the system for nomenclature actually did a pretty darn good job, because I think it's pretty easy. Let's break.